Okie doke. Let's set the stage here. The topic now and next week, or whenever we meet, is casuistry. That's how it's pronounced, casuistry. And today's lecture takes us into the second half of the class. Now, obviously, it's not second half because there's really just today an example of casuistry, narrative, and principalism in summer. So we are actually rapidly heading to the end. But the strategy of the class was to first give us the foundation in the two dominant modes of moral reasoning that we engage in. And those were those are employed in the perspective or the the opinion of moral philosophers by everyone everywhere. Those are the way that human beings, those are the two ways human beings reason morally. The best articulation of those two frameworks is through moral philosophy. It's the moral philosophers who have really carved those out. And so the first half of the class was called The Theories Borrowed by Bioethics. So that's how I organized the first section, because moral philosophy was pretty much all over that, and that's what people spend their time doing. And as we were hiring the new folks, we'll be announcing all of that very soon, a lot of exciting things happening in the department. But as we were going through that process, I think I was saying, oh, you know, we just interviewed a consequentialist, we just interviewed a card-carrying Kantian or whatever. Those are the frameworks that moral philosophers still now spend their time thinking about and tweaking and deepening their understanding of. But now in the second half of the class, we're turning to conceptual work that is done in bioethics proper and not done in philosophy as a discipline. In the Department of Philosophy, anywhere, ever, at least for the last 300 years, you would not hear the word casuistry used unless it was as a substitute for a four-letter word. It would be the polite word instead of some four-letter word that you don't want to say in polite company, though I never hesitate. But casuistry is an absolute dirty word in philosophy. And I'm going to explain to you tonight that the philosophers are just wrong about it. They're just wrong. They just don't understand what casuistry actually brings to the table. And I'll tell you why they've misunderstood it. Because they never got out of the 17th century and the casuistry that had developed and evolved by that point in intellectual history. Whereas bioethicists have taken this and in the model of U.S. legal precedent, and maybe other systems as well, and we've got folks here who know about other nations' legal system, and maybe we can figure out what those systems are like, but the one that I know, not so well, but a little bit, is the U.S. legal system, and the casuistry framework, the casuistry methodology, is through and through the U.S. legal system. So though the moral philosophers didn't pick up on this, because they kind of got stuck in the Enlightenment and never moved on these questions, the legal theorists are all over this, and people in legal practice are all over this. But bioethics, then, seeing that U.S. legal reasoning occurs casuistically, saw that there was a lot of potential here to start to do an analysis of novel moral problems using a casuistical method. And so today, we're going to be looking at a method that I think is absolutely viable in bioethics, is actually practiced in other parts of moral reasoning, just unbeknownst to the moral philosophy. And that launches the last part of the class, where we think about the theories that are either resurrected, in the case of casuistry, by bioethics, or invented by bioethics. After we talk about casuistry for 2 weeks, we'll look at narrative theory. And narrative theory, narratology, that's very much in the realm of medical humanities and bioethics. In fact, in English departments proper, people don't do narrative, illness narratives and narrative studies. And if you take a class with Lance Wehler, you will get a whole story about why that's true and why the English departments have kind of missed a very important arena of narrative and stories and what they mean in terms of their intersection with healthcare and medicine and personal experience of illness. So that'll be the third thing we do, and we'll be doing that through the work of Todd Chambers, who is a friend of mine, and I think has given us a very important way of critiquing the way we do clinical ethics And that will lead us then to the end of the class, where we will look at the theory that was created brand new, de novo, for bioethics, and that's principalism. And principalism, we will look at the Georgetown mantra, the principles that are the core four of bioethics. And when we explore principalism, we will see how it is a version of deontology and perhaps not the best, and that'll help us link all the way back to the very beginning of the class, and hence done. So this part of the class is what conceptual work has either been resurrected or created by bioethics, as opposed to borrowed, which we had in the first section. So today we've launched that with casuistry, which is not a theory, it's a method. Now, there might be controversies out there about, will the real casuistry please stand up? And you get a little bit of that when you see the difference between Eris and, who else do we have? Johnson. And the debates and the tweaking and the whatever. But the interesting thing is that for a methodology that's basically employed universally in the field of bioethics, there's not a lot of theoretical work in it. And I'll tell you a cute little anecdote. When I wrote the paper that we'll do next week, it's a paper that just got reprinted in this animal ethics reader that MIT put out last week. But in this, it's called Casuistry in the Moral Continuum. I got the first, it was published in a journal called Politics and the Life Sciences, and the first reviewer came back to me and said, this writer does not actually understand casuistry. And I thought, oh, that's actually funny, because I don't know what this person thinks casuistry is, but if you can actually say exactly what casuistry is in bioethics right now, you get the prize. So I gave the article to John Eris, the John Eris that you read today. And he thought it was casuistry as he knew it, but it does illustrate that whoever that anonymous reviewer was didn't think I got casuistry. Eris did think I got it right, so we are not exactly sure what casuistry actually is. Nevertheless, whatever its theoretical pitfalls, liabilities, shortcomings, controversies, as a method, I think it's actually very clear. And I'm not going to get into all of those nitty-gritty infighting that's going on in the field about the real casuistry. I'm going to introduce it today as a very effective and important and maybe even an indispensable method for doing moral analysis on the non-consequentialist side. Now, that's going to be an important rub, because if you are a consequentialist, you don't need a methodology, because you have a methodology. It's hard, but all moral reasoning is hard. You've got to figure out, well, what in fact will create the greatest good for the greatest number? But that's the method. That's the analytical approach. So that's what you do. You look at a situation, you think, on balance, will the outcomes be better if we do this, or we're not as good if we do this? So you don't need a method. So it's true that now we spend a lot more time from here to the end on deontology. That's because deontology, it's either its Achilles heel or its you know, shining glory, is very, very complicated. And so casuistry, I'm going to argue, is a method on the non-consequentialist side, on the deontological side. Now, I already argued last week that in the soup that we're going to call non-consequentialism, we're going to include virtue ethics and Kantian ethics. Because in my argument, in my view, which is the dominant view, so it's not like I'm some maverick, but in the dominant view in moral philosophy, Aristotle is the great complement to Kant. And so I'm going to lump all of those together. And the reason it's important for me to be telling you this now, and you're looking at me puzzled, I think, about why I'm mentioning it, it's because casuistry is an Aristotelian method. It is perfectly appropriate, though, for Kantian ethics, too. And the fact that the Kantians don't know it is their loss. So I'm going to teach it as a method. I'm going to argue it's a method for deontological reasoning, and under deontological reasoning, I'm including virtue ethics. Questions about any of that preamble, where we're headed? Shelley?
Just one comment on the narrative, and we haven't studied it yet. I sort of see that as being derived from social work and psychology, looking at the person's story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I see that as a borrow, that has now become moved into bioethics, but I just see that as emanating from human fields that looked at the person as a person and their story.
I agree. I mean, that's the thing. So I think the only thing that was really created by bioethics, per se, was principalism. But when we see the way that Chambers, in 2 weeks, the way he uses the literary theory of genre to illuminate the shortcomings in the way we do clinical ethics, that I think will be really quite novel. But it is based on the idea of these of the narrative. In fact, the last piece we'll read at the end of the semester is a piece I did in academic medicine called "Why the Clinical Ethics We Teach Fails Patients." And basically, I'm just using a therapist, social worker, psychological approach to say, if you were this person that's involved in this case, what would this be like, and what would that experience be like? And I don't know, but we've got to make it up because the guy's dead. But it's the same exact shtick that whole group of folks doing those type of psychological and support services would already have known. Or clergy. I often get clergy saying the same thing.
And the other thing is, will you address, I'm not asking you to answer it now, but the whole notion of the thought example, you know, this whole thought experiment, and whether that's a piece of casuistry, because it seems filtered throughout what we've learned, where people flip to a case. Let's try an example and
how
that relates to...
Examples in casuistry, yes. Thought experiment doesn't have anything to do with casuistry, because thought experiments are designed to be idiosyncratic. They're designed to be bizarre or out of the ordinary. And casuistry, as we're going to understand in a few minutes, is actually trying to start with real cases. So the thought experiment is such a device, such an artificial device, that people who would call themselves casuists would not typically use thought experiments. And if they did, they'd use it in a very casual way. So sometimes, for example, I wrote a paper that came out in January in Academic Medicine, and it was about... It's about cross-cultural understandings and patient-centered care. But in this case, it's a case of a woman who's wearing a burqa who's uncomfortable with a male radiologist. And I say that I'm going to do a thought experiment and take us to Germany, where people don't use gowns in gynecological exams. Because for the American audience, it's hard to imagine a gynecological exam without a gown. It's hair-raising, skin-crawling. And so I use this example, and I call it a thought experiment. It actually isn't. I use it because I can get away with that terminology in a journal called Academic Medicine, because nobody knows the difference. But in a philosophical journal, I wouldn't be able to call that a thought experiment, because that's actually just a comparative case. That's a casuistical case, not really a thought experiment. If it's not about brains in vats, life on Mars, drowning children in bathtubs, it's not a thought experiment. So it's not part of casuistry. Okay, so we're going to talk about casuistry today. It is I Am Freezing. And now you know we're sort of the last part of the semester. No one's going to sit here. I understand. And I don't blame anyone. I appreciate me. Okay. I'm going to talk about how it's a method in bioethics, not philosophy. Its roots are in Aristotle. I'm going to talk about the 16th and 17th century, and I'm going to get through 11 centuries really fast. Then I'm going to talk about as a case comparison method. I'm going to talk about legal precedent. I'm going to use the example of end of life, because that's where we see casuistry very, very distinctly in action. I'm going to lay it out as a method where we start from a paradigm and work to analogy. I'm going to talk about the tool chest, our moral arsenal, I sometimes call it, and how casuists understand that tool chest, I think, in exactly the right way, that we have old or well-worn tools at our disposal, but we're also mining circumstances for new ones. We are trying to expand our moral lens with casuistry, which I think is one of its great virtues. I'm going to talk about why casuists do not like applied ethics and why no one should like applied ethics, but then I'm also going to say no one actually does applied ethics. So this is where I'm going to critique the casuist view of moral philosophy, because it's the same caricature that the moral philosopher's view of the casuist is. You might as well get rid of all caricatures. Then we're going to do discovery. The idea of casuistry is that it's a method that enables you to think out of the box and discover not just insights, but the moral, let's use our terminology, deliberative presumptions that back those insights. And I'm going to use a case of a pretty novel case, I think, for most of you. A case where one gets unsought knowledge of non-paternity in a genetic test, and what and how we would do that analysis through casuistry. We're going to ask the question, what do you do, though, if the field is so brand new that it doesn't look like there's any analogy, there's any foothold, there's any way of finding your way. And then we're actually going to do casuistry by looking at the case of Diane and Debbie. We're going to look at Diane as the paradigmatic case and Debbie then as the analogy case. We're going to mine the case, Diane, to see, well, what do we find? What's in there? What insights do we glean? And then we're going to use those insights to think, what do we now know then about the Debbie case, and what do we see new in Debbie? What allows us what does casuistry allow us to see? And that is our agenda. All right. Let's talk first about, I've already given you a little bit of the spiel about why, or at least I've announced that moral philosophy does not think casuistry is worthwhile. I haven't exactly told you why. Well, it's not because Aristotle liked it. That's certainly not why. Because as I've told you, Kantians now embrace the genius moments of Aristotle, and so some of the things that Aristotle said seem just absolutely dead on, so that wouldn't be enough of a reason, and that isn't the reason. Casuistry wasn't named as a process in Aristotle's work, or at least as far as we have Aristotle's work, because you know that when the library burned, we only have fragments of Aristotle. We don't even know if his main book, The Nicomachean Ethics, was notes that some kid took in his class. I mean, it's pretty, right? It's pretty flimsy. So we don't know what his view of casuistry was, but it's got an Aristotelian flavor to it because it looks at a particular circumstance, a particular situation, and it says, what's the context here? What are the nuances? What are the subtleties? What are the unusual aspects about it that make it different from the run-of-the-mill case of stealing, lying, cheating, killing? That, in fact, if we skip to the what's wrong with applied ethics, is going to be part of the story, that you take those principles. In fact, I have under here, if you can't see it, tools for moral deliberation. If you remember the Herman lecture, that the tool for moral deliberation was the one over here. No, this was the derivation of duties. Oh, my God. All right, I just moved the midterm. That's good. Whoops. Yeah, there you go. I tell you, I swear to God, she can't name these things to save herself, so even I get them mixed up. The derivation of duties model, where you have these duties, they seem very wooden, and then you take the duty and you cookie cutter it onto circumstances, even if the circumstances speak back and say, well, really, is this the whole thing? You got the whole thing captured under thou shalt not steal or whatever. Okay, the point here is that Aristotle didn't like this way of saying, well, is it just? Is it wise? Is it courageous? That he wanted circumstances to speak the whole range of virtues and vices that they had employed in them. So context for Aristotle was incredibly important. The other thing about Aristotle was that he cared very much about this idea of phronesis, which is translated practical wisdom. And this was the idea that as moral agents go through their lives, through the life course, they come to pick up more and more nuance about human interaction and what we owe and what's wrong and why is it wrong, so that the older you get, the more you've been able to see and the more things have texture and can be seen in more relief. And as that happens, you gain more moral. The word practical here isn't practical like, hey, I'm really good as an auto mechanic. It's not practical in that sense. Practical in moral philosophy is always a synonym for moral. So, for example, if you think about Kant's book was called The Critique of Practical Wisdom, Critique of Practical Reason, that you could just pull out the word practical and put in moral reasoning. So practical in this sense means moral. But over time, you get more moral wisdom. Well, casuistry is the strategy of saying, if my analysis of situation A is sound, and if I have a lot of moral confidence about it, what does it teach me then? What have I amassed in terms of my wisdom that I could employ and bring to bear on situation B? And so Aristotle's practical wisdom phronesis actually laid out this casuistical mindset by saying, I learn from one case and I bring it to bear on another case, which is another reason why casuistry is born through Aristotle. But then Aristotle dies, in 300 BCE. And when casuistry gets picked up again in the post-Aristotelians, in the post-Aristotelian thought, for example, of the early Catholic theologians, it starts out a pretty good idea. Hey, let's think about one moral situation and compare it to another. But over time, and there's a lot of nasty that goes on here, but by the time you get to the 16th and 17th century, casuistry started to become very rote and very pedantic and very too big for its britches, where it would say as a method, if I have analyzed case 361, here's what we do with case 362. And it got to the point where it was so micro nitpicking and distinction making that casuists of the time, especially by the 17th century, were making volumes like the Encyclopedia of Moral Life. You want to know if you should have if you should commit adultery? Well, look in volume 3 and see what your situation is. Do you have a frigid wife? Do you have an ugly wife? Do you have an unemployed spouse? You know, you could look up here all the different reasons that would give you various shades of evilness of the action adultery, for example. Well, clearly, that's not what Aristotle meant, right? He didn't mean that you could actually reify it, that you could actually lay down the analysis encyclopedically so that whenever you had a moral problem, you just needed a really good index. So something went awry because Aristotle wanted you to develop your dexterity here, skill of practical wisdom, moral reasoning. He didn't want you to be really good at using the moral equivalent of the thesaurus. And that's what they had become, the thesaurus, basically, of moral life. That's what the late casuists had become. And then this guy Pascal basically says, this is such utter crap, so not sophisticated, so not morally nuanced here, that when you want a moral answer, you just go to the volume and look it up. That's not what casuistry was supposed to be. In fact, he didn't say that. He said, casuistry is ridiculous. We need to stop this mode of moral analysis. And that was the 17th century. And the moral philosophers never got beyond that. They heard it. It sounded right. It seems right to me, too. And so casuistry then became the ridiculous quest to nail down moral analysis by categorization of various permutations on bad behavior. Now, clearly, that's not what Aristotle meant, and that's where it got to. And so it became ridiculed, something that was seen to be, you can imagine the casuists themselves, they're all puffed up about how great their analysis is. Give me a permutation, I'll give you an answer, I'll give you a read on it. Clearly not the right way to go. And that's why Johnson and Toulmin wrote the book with the strange title, The Abuse of Casuistry. Because they wrote a book explaining how casuistry went from a pretty good idea to, if I've got some moral analysis from one situation, could I bring some of that experience, know-how, knowledge, insight to bear on another of Aristotle, and got it into the ridiculous 15 volumes of morally good behavior by the 17th century. That's the story Johnson and Toulmin tell in the book called The Abuse of Casuistry. And that's the beginning of the book, Abuse of Casuistry. And the end of the book is, we can resurrect it. Not only can we resurrect it, we have resurrected it in a very neighboring field, in the field of legal reasoning in U.S. law. And now, knowing that, we can move it to bioethics. That's the story. Okay. So what is casuistry? Let's get our little definition here on page 348. They offset it kindly for us. That offset, Johnson and Toulmin, that's the book, the 1998 book, The Abuse of Casuistry. I don't assign it because do you really need to read 400 pages of how casuistry went astray? I just told it to you. That's how it went astray. So I assign the encyclopedia version because I don't think you get any more out of the actual big book. So, and besides that, I think it's like the game Othello. It takes 5 minutes to learn to play and a lifetime to master. I don't think casuistry needs a book to explain what it actually is doing. I think we're going to have it covered in the next half hour. So here's our indentation. The analysis of moral issues,
good,
using procedures of reasoning based on a paradigm and analogy, I'll explain that, leading to the formulation of expert opinion, at least consensus opinion or widespread opinion or the received view about the existence and stringencies of particular moral obligations. That is, we have certain moral obligations, and how powerful, how compelling. Is this a weak obligation? Like, sure, that would be nice to have, or is this an absolute stringency? That's what it means there. Framed in terms of moral rules and maxims that are general, right? This is Aristotelian. They hold in general and for the most part, but not universal or invariable. This is Herman's deliberative presumption idea. Since they hold good with certainty only in typical conditions of the agent and circumstances of the case. In other words, if you've got a very simple case here, my iPhone on the table, should you take it? No, it holds very clearly, very universally, you should not take it. True. But if I'm humming some little ditty, you don't think you ever heard it before, but it you know, lands in your mind, it implants an idea, and from that you develop some more notes in it, and suddenly you've got a melody. Did you steal that melody? I don't know. We got to think about it. That's what it means about hold certain in certain case universally, but sometimes, you know, only in the typical conditions, in the atypical conditions, is it stealing? Is it not? Something you got to think about it. That's casuistry. The bottom line there is this move from paradigm to analogy, which we're going to talk about in a minute. So it's a case comparison method defined by finding the maxims, that's just the Kantian word for moral consideration or deliberative presumption, and then using those to get insight about that case and taking it to another. Well, that should give you resonance if you know anything about U.S. legal precedent, because in legal reasoning, and I know we got lawyers in here who will know a whole lot more about this than I do, but when you're thinking about the next case, the current case, you are hearkening back to past cases. If you were with me in the fall, you've seen this, even if you're not a lawyer, not familiar with U.S. legal reasoning, you saw this in the piece called The Philosopher's Brief by Dworkin et al. In that piece, they use the precedents, it's an end-of-life case, it's a physician-assisted suicide case that they're talking about, but they hearken back to Cruzan, which is an end-of-life case, and Casey, which is a Planned Parenthood case, which is an abortion case. And the reason they hearken back is because they believe that there are insights that the court has established as being legally valid that can then be brought to bear on the current case, even though the cases were not, they were analogous in the sense that they had something that could be brought to bear, but they weren't actually the same topics, because they were not withdrawal of care, it's physician-assisted suicide, and they were not abortion, beginning of life, they were end of life. And so you saw there this use of past cases. And any time you read a legal opinion, you see this kind of hearkening back. So I don't know if any of you who are legally trained want to chime in there with any other insights from U.S. law.
An example would be the Roe v. Wade, the fundamental insight or principle that was used is the issue of privacy, which was sort of derived from a number of sources to sort of do the striking blow on the case.
And they named them, right? They would say, this was from the, and I don't know what they were, but Griswold, or who knows what the...
Right, and just the Constitution as well.
And that's the neat thing, and I like that you said that, because one of the problems that bioethics casuistry is going to have that U.S. legal reasoning doesn't have is that at the end of the day, whatever that thing actually says, we all agree that there is this thing called the U.S. Constitution. Now, there's all this legal wrangling and, oh my gosh, what does it say and how far does it extend and all of that. But at least in legal reasoning, you can have a landing point, whereas in bioethics, you don't have any agreed upon landing point. You might say the Bible, the Quran, the I Ching, or whatever it is, but we don't all agree on it. So the problem is, in bioethics, we're kind of floating here with the, you know, do unto others, goose for the gander, you know. I mean, we're not going to have a landing point. Now, how much of a landing point is it? Well, obviously, it must be fairly hard to get agreement on what its actual implications are, because everybody says, no, no, the Constitution says, and no, think about the philosopher's brief. Both the people who argued there should be a federal right to physician-assisted suicide and the people who argue there absolutely is not a federal right to physician-assisted suicide both said that they could find it in the Constitution. But nevertheless, there is a Constitution, and we don't have that in bioethics. So it's not perfect, but...
The only thing I wonder is in legal precedent is what the difference is between that and a volume, an encyclopedic volume of cases. So if you were to take all the cases of precedents and you bound them in a bunch of volumes and you had a case that was dead on, so you're bound by precedents. If you can distinguish the case, you're not. But how does that differ looking at
from the abuse of casuistry?
From going back in time when people were making fun of volumes, because there are volumes of these. If you put
right,
them all
right,
together, what
right.
you've got is a bunch of volumes.
Right, right.
A situation.
Right. So that's a very interesting criticism of the person who says, how does legal reasoning escape the pitfalls of casuistry of the 17th century? But it is not a good criticism of bioethics, because bioethics is only at trying to analogize to legal precedent. It doesn't actually have any tome. So it's escaped the problem that you've identified that maybe legal reasoning has. And in fact, people do say things like that. Isn't this crazy that we've got all these volumes of cases and you have nitpicking and all that? They do say it, so they make the same criticism. But luckily for bioethics, both legal reasoning and those tomes of casuistry are in the same camp. They're just a metaphor for bioethics. Bioethics doesn't practice in that way. It can hearken in a gesture, but it doesn't actually have any, here's the tome. It just has arguments and instances and, yes, received views, but they're not going to be cataloged in any way like that. So bioethics escapes the problem that legal reasoning may not.
It may not, but it does have this notion of binding precedent. So it's not like every 1,000 cases that came before, these are the cases that, for a structure that's been set up, to apply. And that could just be a universe of 10 at most, or even 1 in one case. So it's not as if...
So I don't know enough about
my
law.
My issue is, I mean, not that I agree that law has the same... That problem, but perhaps the problem isn't as grave as we think it is, because there is the notion of certain cases are binding precedent.
And what does that mean? What is
it? It means because a court higher that the court deciding is bound by the precedent in cases that's been decided by a court that's higher to it. So the Supreme Court is binding precedent for all courts in the land. So there are ways, because of a pre-done structure, there are ways that you can...
Okay, so Cruzan is a Supreme Court case, and Quinlan is a New Jersey state case, so we don't have to go revisit all of the cases that would be at the Quinlan, that would be Quinlan decisions, because if Cruzan says you are allowed to have withholding of food and hydration, we don't have to go back to Quinlan and say, no, you can't.
But that doesn't mean that through chipping away at precedent by finding one case or another case, right. there can be a situation mm-hmm. that over time
so
that you start, you know, attacking the
it's a problem, case. But not to the level that it was in the 17th century with the volumes. Okay. All right, but it's an interesting point nevertheless. We are only going to use it as a metaphor. So now we're in our metaphor. So let's think about, for example, end of life. And let's think about the way in which, in bioethics, the first case out there that everybody talked about was Quinlan and the withdrawal of the respirator for Quinlan. And in that case, the thought was, does a competent person, and she wasn't, but they treated her as if she were. They were trying to figure out whether even a competent person could allow the withdrawal of her own air, whether you could sanction that, whether you could allow that of your own body. That was what was at issue. It wasn't actually a surrogate decision-making case, though of course it was a surrogate decision-making case. She's in a PBS state and no way competent. But the reasoning behind it was, do I have the right to reject treatment of my on my body? And then, thank you, and then the question became, What about surrogates? How far do surrogates get to go in deciding about the withdrawal of ventilator support? And then when that was thought of, then there was this question of, but what about when it's not air at all? It's actually food and hydration, a different type of thing, a kind of thing that went that normally, that we had up to that point, not normally, up to that point thought of as not medical care at all. We thought breath being assisted was medical care, but food and hydration we didn't think of as medical care. Are they both medical care? Are they analogous? So as people reasoned through from the Quinlan case to the Cruzan case, they definitely did use this compare and contrast mode. That is how bioethicists do it. So what does that mean? It means that folks start with a paradigm case, a case that has been somehow settled, and I don't mean unanimous because that's too much in a country like this, but received view, accepted view. Now, it turns out to be the case that I am both using a moral case in Quinlan and a legal case in Quinlan, because Quinlan was an actual legal case. So strip away the fact that it's Karen and Quinlan, and let's think beyond the law, because I want to get us away from that metaphor now, to just talk the way that bioethicists, clinical ethicists, reason. They would say, we've got someone here who's in a PVS state, no hope of any recovery, needs very high intervention, and has left very clear instructions not to have life prolonged in a case that's so clearly futile for his or her recovery, and it's a respirator case. Let's imagine we're that kind of case. And through dialogue and question, and the one question is, well, how did we get an analysis of the paradigm case? But leave that just for a minute. Once we have that case settled, we say, yes, you may have respirator withdrawn. Then we come to another case, an analogy case, that has similar features, but now, for example, let's say it's not the individual who's left clear instructions. There are, let's say, unclear instructions, but it's still a respirator case. Or maybe that's not what makes it an analogy case. Maybe it's not that it's an unclear case. Maybe it's not a ventilator case at all. It's a food and hydration case. But it's still got a lot of parallels to the first case, and therefore it's an analogy. So the method of casuistry is to think about what did we have in the analysis of the first case, the paradigm case, what were our tools, what was in our moral arsenal, what were our considerations, and now that we're in the analogy case, which of those insights, moral considerations, prohibitions, or principles can we bring to bear, and what's new? We have to think in this case, in the next case, the analogy case, what did we not see? What is brand new? What breaks new ground? And sometimes that's going to mean that we end up with uncertainty, and sometimes we actually come up with new moral insights that say, I see clarity here, and here's why. Because in comparison of the case analogy to case paradigm, we have these various considerations that give us moral insight or clarity in our decision making. That is why Aris and Johnson Toulmin talk about these old principles and the mining for new principles. If you think about the case of paradigm to analogy, you might have, for example, a bunch of principles. Let's use X's, red X's, to describe them. And these are the principles that helped get the moral answer, the resolution in the paradigm case. In the analogy case, you see that a whole bunch of those moral principles or considerations can be brought to bear in the second case. But now you see that there are new insights that are brought into relief. And they're not just facts. These X's and little R's on the board, they don't represent just moral facts. They represent moral principles. The tools that are in your tool chest of moral analysis, your deliberative presumptions, for example, your moral reasons. And in the analogy case, you mine the case to actually have new moral considerations. Now, armed with all of the moral considerations that you had from the paradigm case and all the ones that you employed in the analogy case and the new ones, you could go on even to another analogy case, bringing all of that moral reasoning, all of that moral wisdom, phronesis, to bear in case three. What that means, then, is that your tool chest through casuistry is ever expanding. And that's what I call the expanded moral lens. It's going to be what I argue is the prime problem, the central liability of principalism. Not principalism maybe as Beecham and Childress articulated it, but certainly principalism as it's practiced on the ground by bioethics. Because the bioethicists who use principalism in the most common way that it's employed take four principles and cookie-cutter them on circumstances, come what may. They don't look at the circumstances and let the circumstances say, hey, you know, we've never really thought, and I'll give you an example, we've never really thought about this, and there is something morally relevant about this particular new consideration that we should be bringing to bear. It simply uses the same set of moral principles, and it cookie-cutters the analysis on all cases. And then that means the lens never expands. The tool chest never expands. All you do is apply a principle or four, whatever they are, to all new situations rather than from the ground up. You hear this a lot of language in John Aris, about from the ground up, letting the case speak. Because if you're coming top down with just a bunch of wooden deliberative presumptions or duties, you just impose them on cases, rather than having a dialogue between the old, the well-worn, well-trod principles you bring to bear, and the new ones that bubble up from the case themselves. Like what? Let's make it real. Let's make it concrete. One of the things bioethicists tend to not think about at all, in fact, I can prove it to you, is the moral distress of practitioners. The experience of moral discomfort or assault on the part of the person who's actually the provider of one stripe or another. Look at the top of page 389 in the encyclopedia piece, the casuistry piece, the Johnson and Toulmin. Johnson and Toulmin, mostly it was Johnson, wrote a book on clinical ethics. It's the encyclopedia piece, right up here.
349.
Johnson wrote a book with a whole bunch of other people on, I think it's called Clinical Pragmatism, or it's from this book. Let's see, 1992. What's this book called? 1992. Somebody's probably getting faster than I have it. Johnson, 1992. Clinical Ethics, A Practical Approach to Ethical Decisions in Clinical Medicine. And it's Ziegler, Winslade, William, and Johnson. Very, very famous book in clinical ethics analysis, which I hate. And why do I hate it? Because it tries to methodologize this approach to clinical ethics decision making by reifying four categories and doing an analysis on only four dimensions. What dimensions? Number one, medical indications. Number two, patient preferences. Number three, quality of life. And number four, contextual features like cost of care and allocation of resources. Now, I have no problem when you do an analysis of clinical ethics analysis, of looking at these four things. My worry is, if you say to yourself, I'm only going to look for these four things, you're only going to find these four things. But that doesn't mean that the relevant features of the case can actually be boxed in those four small boxes. Because, for example, where do you see the moral distress of the practitioner in this? Where do you see the agony of, or the feeling that a practitioner has of assaulting a patient who seems to this practitioner to be beyond saving, but the loved ones desire certain kind of care for that individual? It actually it takes from the soul of the practitioner to put their labor into something, into a process of a body that's actually not salvageable. It what is that word that
means?
What is it? Yeah, futile is the word, but I mean that when you feel dehumanizing is kind of the word, but it means like it you bleed from the soul for it. It's like you
soul destroying.
You know, something like that. You just feel like it empties you out to feel like you're taking your expertise and your labor that could actually be used for the human good, and to be pummeling someone that you feel you're actually just making suffer through all of that effort. Well, whatever that word would be, and then we talked last week about how we don't really have that great a moral language right now. You know, maybe we never did, but it's hard to get that into an adjective or two. Point, it's not in those four boxes. So even in the casus method, they seem to me to be violating the central principle of casuistry. Now, I can understand that you might give me the objection that the fourth category, contextual features, is so broad that anything that you could think of could fit under contextual features. I don't deny it. But that's a different question, because that says I take my four boxes and I look through those four lenses on the, into the case through my four boxes. Is a very different approach than saying, yes, I do that, but then I let the case speak. And I let the case indicate to me whether there are new moral considerations that had never been thought of before. And maybe one whole box needs to be the experience of the practitioner and what the moral sensibilities are of the practitioner. I don't know. I'm not saying yes or no. I'm saying that when you come and you look for only certain things, you only find certain things. Well, ironically, that's what Johnson is advocating in a piece on casuistry, where the very insight of casuistry is to criticize applied ethics, which is exactly that. So even the casuists sometimes can't live up to their own casuistry. And this book actually tells you to take a box like this. It actually, I should have brought the actual book. And it tells you to fill in the boxes literally when you're doing clinical ethics case analysis as a clinical ethics consultant. That's what Johnson's text tells you to do. So I don't think Johnson's the casuist he wishes he were. So instead, we're going to think this way about the heiress casuistry, where you've got to let the case bubble up new moral considerations. Because as we go through different cases and different experiences, we come to see many, many more things. I'll give you another example. I gave you one on moral distress. Here's another. American bioethics thinks about the atomized patient. The patient alone on an island. I have one patient. I have a responsibility to one person, says the provider. That bioethics has as its unit of analysis the individual, because culturally, the United States is a very individualistic kind of place. But what we have learned from other places that think in very different ways is a truth, a truism, it seems, about human beings. Guess what? They're not humans on islands. They actually are part of social webs. They actually are part of family systems, friendship and kinship networks. And what happens to one significantly impacts others. And so our hyper-focus on one person has actually led perhaps to the detriment indirectly of that person, but maybe even an entire family system or friendship network, or even maybe a social network. So now, having understood that new insight, we have something called family-centered care. And this is all the buzz, right? This is all the buzz now. If you walk over to HUP, the progressive thinking now is, how do we make hospitals like these, you know, huge tertiary care centers, how do we make them family-centered? Because the family, has we have come to understand, is one of the important variables and maybe the central unit in the analysis of giving good patient care for all kinds of reasons. But that's from the experience we've had and the feedback and the dialogue with patients who have been ill and providers who have treated them. So casuistry actually makes possible things like a novel approach, family-centered care, or learning from other cultures and other practices and other institutions worldwide. Not only just, you know, across various localities, but also in other parts of the world, and maybe even at other times. Casuistry makes that possible because it lets experience bubble up. So one of the things I do in my work is start with a case and try to show, in whatever particular point I'm trying to make, how there are things in this case that we have not seen, which is why we have treated the case in the way that we have in the past treated it. So like this paper about the woman in the burqa, the typical American response is, you get who you get and you don't get upset. You get a man, too bad, I'm a man. That's all we've got. Or take it or leave it. That's been the traditional approach. I'm just as qualified as anybody else. I come into your room, that's who you get. But maybe We actually wouldn't want to be treated that way, we Americans, if we went to another place. And that's why I use the German gynecological practice, because no woman would want to be having a gynecological exam with a male practitioner with no drape, no gown. So having that experience in this thought experiment I give tries to show that there's more to this case than our typical way of my way or the highway. Point, that's a casuistical mode of analysis. Let the case speak, but also, yes, bring your tools from past cases. Let me stop here for a minute and see where we are. Questions, see how we're understanding it. That's this point here about the tool chest of old principles and mining them, and it's also a way of starting to talk about what's wrong with applied ethics.
I don't know if enough time has passed such that, let's say, there is a paradigm on a particular issue and enough exceptions have come up during the analogizing process that the exceptions ask one to sort of question the paradigm.
Okay.
Over time. But I don't know if enough time has passed when cases have come through and, you know, how
there has to be a dialogue between past cases mm-hmm. and current cases, because it could turn out, as it does once in a while, even with the U.S. Supreme Court,
right.
that they rethink.
Right.
So their Lawrence case mm-hmm. was a case of revisiting their Bowers case.
Right.
Right, exactly. So that's a case, for those of you who were not following this, the U.S. Supreme Court said that same-sex couple in the privacy of their own home did not have the right to sexual practice of sodomy in the Bowers case in the 80s. They revisited it in Lawrence in the early 2000s, like 2003 or 4, and they said absolutely there's a right to sexual practice between two consenting adults in the privacy of their own home. What seems stunning that it took them that long to figure that out, but okay, they did, and they reversed their Bowers decision. It happens in bioethics too. We'd have to think about where and in what ways. But I think that the family-centered care movement is getting us to rethink some of our presumptions about what is the right thing to do in certain cases, or other developments that we're having. I'll give you a better example than that one. In our understanding of human psychology and why people make choices that they do and what those choices mean. That's very cryptic. Let me give you an example. We are so pro-autonomy in the United States on this continuum of autonomy to paternalism. We have swung so far over on the autonomy side that the received view among House staff and probably attendings is that if somebody says no to something, that's what it is. No is no. Can you read my lips? No is no. So in this one paper, and I'm not the only person who's on this, who's trying to get us to revisit that standard approach to what patients mean when they say no to a particular procedure. That our desire to respect autonomy sometimes doesn't have us scratch the surface of why somebody might be saying no, and to see if there would be other ways of delivering what this person wants or meeting that person's needs that does not involve their having to simply take no for an answer without exploration. Like what? I use this case of this person who, and you'll see it in 3 weeks, this person who says no to having a central line, though the central line would be life-saving in this if there was a GI bleed. The person says no. And the typical way of an American clinical ethics analysis is he's competent, lucid, he understands the facts, he said no. But I scratch my head and say, why would somebody 30 years old say no, has said yes to so many other things, say no to a central line? There's no religious belief that would explain it, no suicidality that would explain it. Why would this person say no? And my analysis, which you'll agree with or you won't agree with, is maybe this person is saying no because the only thing this person can get control over is a yes or no on this particular question. So maybe if we really found out why is saying no so important in this particular moment for this person, maybe we would find out that saying no to the central line isn't actually the guy's goal. The goal is actually, I want to assert my autonomy, I need to assert my agency, I need to regain power in this circumstance, and the vehicle I'm using is no to the central line. Well, if that's true, maybe we could give him his agency and power back, and he could still decide that he wants the central line. And if he had decided that, if we had been able somehow to empower him, maybe he'd actually be alive. Because the end of the story is he died because they took no for an answer. They didn't explore it. He ended up saying no, held his ground. I wouldn't ever trump his wishes. I wouldn't advocate that. But they took no for an answer in a very straightforward way. He had a GI bleed, and he died. He was 30 years old.
Is that a desire to have some sort of a bright-line test when people have limited time and limited resources? I'm not advocating for a bright-line test, of course.
I don't think so, because in this particular case, the person was in the ICU, so everything was on board. You know, he had said yes and yes and yes and yes and no to the central line. And they explained the facts. He said no. And they explained the facts, and he said no. You'll see it in a couple of weeks. I'll try to give an analysis that says that maybe we shouldn't be just saying, do we trump his wishes or do we honor his wishes? Maybe we actually have an obligation to do something else, like explore his wishes, understand his wishes. Well, if that's true, right now, in the way that this case is typically analyzed, we got two things going. Respect his wishes and or deny his wishes. And I said, in this case, maybe we actually have to question. Maybe we actually have an obligation to sit down and explore his wishes, to actually understand his goals. Maybe that's not a wish list. Maybe that's an obligation. Maybe there wasn't just two obligations in the case. Maybe there's three. So the case, to me, spoke of a brand new obligation. We have an obligation, a demand, binding on us to say, but why would you want that? And how can I help? What can I do to get you what you need? Is this what you need? And if it's not what you need, how do I get you what you need? And if that's an obligation, then it's a new moral obligation, not one that in our polarization, our dichotomy of accept what he wants, deny what he wants, there's actually another way. That's casuistry in action. Okay, and that's that ties in to applied ethics, because the way that we have it right now, the critique of applied ethics is that you've got your tools and you use them. You don't look for any new tools, you just use them. You got a hammer, you got a wrench, use them. But what if you actually need a feather duster? Well, that's why people critique applied ethics. Because if your view of doing analysis is take your tools and use them, you're not looking for new tools. Now, moral philosophers are the last people on earth who would actually be the practitioner of the open up the toolbox and take out your drill and your hammer and see what you can do with it. Moral philosophers are the wrong target for a critique that's actually, in my mind, quite valid. I see in bioethics this constantly. The way that the fourth-year medical school ethics class has been taught in the past and will not be any longer was that on the first day, they were basically taught, you've got beneficence and you've got autonomy. Go at it. And basically, they're taught, apply. Should you honor his wishes? That would be respect autonomy. Or should you trump it in paternalism and do what would be best for him, which is clearly, since he's not suicidal, get the central line to get that bleed under control, beneficence. Autonomy versus beneficence, go. Go at it. So that is the way it's taught. It's just that moral philosophers would laugh at that analysis. So they're the wrong target for the critique of applied ethics, which John Aris delivers, but it doesn't mean that there isn't application of principles going on in bioethics. There is, and it's not casuistical.
Mm-hmm. But surely, even in a principalist approach, there's room for looking at a new principle. I mean, nothing stops. Nothing in life stops. I mean, you can't. Is it that reductionist that nobody ever says maybe there's another thing so, without going this whole casuistic approach?
No, good. So there's two, and I don't want to have that lecture tonight, but it's a good question. The answer to your question is the people who created principalism, Beecham and Childress, would never have wanted what has actually happened in the way that their theory has been bastardized and used. So the answer is absolutely principalism lets for room. I mean, Kantian thought comes all the way up to one principle. Do unto others as you want others to do unto you, right? Act in a way that your action could become a universal law of nature. And yet, all the things we think that we care about deontologically, the Kantian says come from it. Don't humiliate. Don't embarrass. Don't pour salt in a wound. You know, don't be inconsiderate. You know, whatever. It all comes from one. So surely, if it all can come from one, it can all come from four. But that's different from the way that it actually gets practiced on the ground. That's not Beecham and Childress's fault. but it is something we've got to do something about, and that's why I write on casuistry and how we need to have a different use of these tools, because we have to understand our tool chest as having the potential to ever expand. Rather than limit ourselves, look, I got two great tools, we should say to ourselves, how many tools can we find over time as we develop our moral reasoning? And that's a casuistical spirit. Okay, well, we've talked about the discovery angle then in this metaphorical way. Let's think for a minute here before we get to our really concrete case of, our written out case of Diane and versus Debbie. Let's think about an example case. Think, how do you pick an analogy? Because with Diane and Debbie, I've already decided Diane's going to be the paradigm case and Debbie's going to be the analogy case. I shouldn't have to fight real hard for it, but I will try to justify it briefly, and then I probably, it's not a controversial claim, I don't think, which is the paradigm and which should be the analogy case. Because the paradigm case should be a case where there should be broad consensus about its moral soundness. And what I'm going to argue about the case of Diane is this. If it's ever morally permissible for a physician to assist in a patient's, in a terminal patient's death, Diane is that case. Now remember, I didn't say it is morally permissible for a physician to assist someone who's dying. I said if it's ever permissible, it seems to me that the way Quill went about it was pretty darn thorough. I don't know whether he's right, but if not Quill, then no one. That's what I'm going to argue. And if that's true, if you agree with me, then that would be a good paradigm case for if it's ever permissible, this is what it looks like. And then we'll look at Debbie, where even if it is sometimes permissible, it surely wasn't permissible in Debbie. So that's why it's going to look like an analogy case. But how do you pick the analogy cases when you've landed yourself with a case? So I'm going to give you a case, and let's see what you come up with for what's the paradigm here. So I'm going to give you an analogy case. We know it can't be a paradigm case, because what should we do? You're going to be swimming and reeling just like I was when I heard it. So I'm going to give you an analogy case. You know you're in an analogy case when you're like, oh my gosh, I don't know. You know you're in a paradigm case, or at least one you want to advocate, where you say, if it's ever good to do this, by God, it was good in that case. And that's what we're going to have when we get to Diane. Now, here's a case. There is a couple. They have a baby. The baby has, the dad has a genetic disease. And they want to test the baby for, and it's not a life-limiting, but it's one that would have to have some kind of monitoring and chronic care, whatever. So they want to know if the baby's got the genetic disease. They know the dad has it, and they want to know if the baby has it. But they take the mom, it's not a maternal thing, the mom doesn't have it. It's passed on through the paternal line. They have, though, the baby's blood, but they want to have a control. They want to be able to compare the baby to the mom. For reasons I've forgotten. So they get the mom's blood so that they can have a control and then look at the baby. And in this test, they find out the baby's not the mom's. The baby was born of the mom, but the baby has no genetic relationship to the mom. So now we have one of two things gone on here. One, this was an egg switch in the fertility clinic, or this was, what? What'd you say?
I didn't realize I thought it was the whole fertility clinic thing. I didn't say it.
I'm announcing it now.
Okay. Oh, well, good. Then I didn't miss it.
No. Because when they did the test, it wasn't relevant to know that there was a fertility clinic involved, right? They just had a baby, they had a kid, they had a dad. Why should they tell the genetic counselor and the pediatrician about whether they used a fertility clinic, right? It's not part of the original, the beginning story. But now it turns out, obviously, some type of assisted reproduction was used here, because absolutely that was the baby that came out of that mom. And that baby has no relationship to the mom. The mom never mentioned that she had no relationship to that baby. Because if you're going to come to me after I've gotten baby here, and you're going to say, Autumn, I'd like your blood for a control so that we can test your baby. If I've used an egg donor, I probably say to you, well, it won't help because I used an egg donor. So it's not going to work for you like a control, right? Presumably. And nothing was said. So it turns out this baby's not the mom's. Now, one of two things happened. One, the mom doesn't want it known that she used an egg donor. Or two, the eggs got switched in the fertility clinic. It's definitely the husband's. The sperm was his. The egg was not. Okay. So I'm calling this unsought knowledge of, and it's, I use the word paternity, but it's really maternity. Okay, so now the baby turns out not to have the genetic disease of the dad. And it is the dad's baby. So what they ask, the answer is, in fact, the baby has no problem at all. Baby's great. So they didn't seek the knowledge of the maternity. Nobody knows that that question is actually being asked. The baby is absolutely healthy, and it is the dad's baby. It doesn't have the genetic disease. But the question that the lab has now is, do they tell the mom, this baby isn't your baby? Because not only does the mom get to know then that this is not her baby, but there's the question, does the lab have to figure out whose baby is it? Because imagine the scenario is this. The eggs got switched before they were fertilized in the petri dish. And the mom, the real biological egg giver to this, didn't even either had a kid through the fertility clinic or never succeeded. So there is now a baby, potentially from an infertile mom out there. It's that woman's baby, but she doesn't get to have that baby. The lab knows it's not the person who has it. And that mom, because she obviously used a fertility clinic, also is at risk of never having her own baby, but now it is the baby whose father is her husband. It's so catastrophic.
Is this a real one?
Yeah.
You made it up?
No. Ooh. You can't make shit like this. You can't. Now, what's the paradigm? If we're going to use, and we're not going to try to settle it here, because we've already all lined up. I mean, some of you are just like, oh my God, I have no idea. And some of you are, do not tell her. And others are absolutely tell her. And it doesn't matter. That's the whole problem with an analogy case. I guarantee it, there's somebody on each of those three positions. But let's try not to duke that debate out here. What I want you to figure out is, what are you going to use to dialogue? And we're not going to dialogue, but what would you use as the paradigm case? Because one of the critiques of casuistry is, when you've got PVS person on a ventilator, and written instructions, PVS person on a ventilator, no written instructions, PVS in no instructions, and now food and hydration, you kind of know where you trace back to. But where do you trace back to when you're in an arena so novel, so landmined? Where do you trace it back to, huh?
We go back to a research. So if you wanted a situation to go back to, it certainly comes up in a research context. This was a treatment context, right? Where you would have evidence of non-paternity. Usually it's non-paternity, not non-maternity. So you could see what's that in the research context.
So one thing you could look at is other non-paternity cases. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what would, if that was your paradigm, if you were using a non-paternity case, what would be the disanalogies? Give me the kind of non-paternity typical case. I don't even know if it has to be research. It could be non-paternity you find out in research, or non-paternity, I guess you're going to say non-paternity in research is going to be more analogous, because if it were clinical, somebody would actually have had to ask for it to happen often. And that would be one of the big problems here. That nobody asked the question, am I the mom of this baby? Nobody asked it.
But I mean, I've had cases like this before that I've seen in bioethics where nobody asks if it's the father, where they're looking for one genetic disease or whatever that is passed down through the father, and they find another one. So that, like, that this man isn't carrying, so therefore he is not the father. They're checking for, I don't know, Tay-Sachs or something. And they come up with that with Huntington's. Mm-hmm. but I don't know, the mother doesn't. So then, like, it, they're looking clinically not at paternity, but that becomes an issue in the case, or an issue
okay.
in the clinic. So that would be analogous, I think, right?
Okay. But what would be disanalogous in it?
Oh, what would be disanalogous is that, you know, there's not, like... I think that it doesn't have bearing on somebody else's, like, medical situation. Like, there's no, like, satellite case because you're assuming that in the clinic there's another mother whose egg that was.
So so here's one of the reasons why non-paternity versus non-maternity is different.
Okay.
The mother knows it's a possibility that it was not hers unless she used a... sperm, you know, unless the problem was his sperm and they used in vitro and it was fertilized in the dish and they mixed up the sperm, that might be an analogy case, though, you know, we don't have a lot of it. If it's a paternity case, presumably the mom actually knows. So, right? Well, she knows that it...
is possible.
She knows it's possible. She doesn't know if it's Joe or Jim.
That's right.
But she does know that Joe or Jim might be possibilities, unless it was an in vitro kind of situation where they mixed up the sperm. Whereas, you know, if in this case, nobody, not the dad or the mom, could see any of this coming. Right? Imagine that you're the mom and you're having your baby tested for the genetic disease of the dad's line. You have to know there's a risk that the hanky-panky's coming out, right? Whereas in this case, this couple has not either one of them have any notion that this is coming.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of another case.
Okay, what?
Switch at birth, like in hospitals. Like you always even like tag women, like
all right. Now, good. So, all right. So the switched at birth. Now, why is the switched at birth not analogous?
Because the woman actually carried the child.
I think there's a bigger reason why the switched at birth. Well, there's two babies. You could switch them back. I mean, right? I mean, here, what you've got, right? I mean, presumably, when you've got this baby in that family and this baby in that family, it's not going to... I don't know what the ultimate answer is, but... this baby is actually constructed of those two people who are actually a couple, and this baby is constructed of those two people who are a couple, and if you switched them back, and I don't know if you could, and it's complicated, and if it's years later, and I don't know what, but the point is, they actually have a husband-wife, or, you know, in the traditional sense, they've got the two people who had sex actually are the ones who made the baby. In this baby, you have the mom married to somebody else and the dad married to the person who carried the baby. So you can't actually just make the baby go back to the home of its biological parents, because regardless, one person who's a biological donor of this kid lives with someone else.
Switch the spouses.
So
right.
the best paradigm for an analogy would be the one that removes only one variable?
Not necessarily. But the question is, which variable do you want to remove? Right? So
this one has so many, it would be hard to figure out.
Well, this one is particularly trying. This is very difficult because it's going to depend, my guess is, on which position you take, which paradigm you select. For example, if you believe that you're sorry for the woman who may not actually get to have her baby, but you don't think that this couple's life should be turned upside down, or this child's life should be, let's say you're that person, you think that is tragic, but she carried it, and so she's going to bond with it as hers. It is her husband. They're an intact family. That's their kid. And it's unfortunate that there was a biological mishap in a donor, but the donor mom had her eggs out there, so that's terrible. It is. It's absolutely terrible. But all things considered, let's say you do a consequentialist analysis, or I don't know what your principles are, but you say, I believe that most importantly, that it's important not to ruin the lives of these three people, the people that we have in front of us.
Yeah, her life isn't any different before or after the knowledge.
Who's? Unless
the woman who would have gotten the baby.
Right.
So her life is not different.
Yeah, I'm not siding for this position. I'm saying if that is the position you take, then you probably aren't happy with the paradigm cases that have already been selected, because the switch at birth almost always results in we are going to re-identify whose parent should get the kids. It's a disclosure. I don't know what's going to happen in non-paternity of the clinical.
That's not like principles. Okay, so like in this one, if you take the principle that you're taking away all choices, if you impose a decision, you're taking away all choices. You're taking away autonomy.
Right?
And autonomy means both saying, no, I don't want this information, but it also means having the possibility of information. So somebody comes and says, I have some information about your son or whatever it is. Do you want to know this information? It's not relevant to that. He doesn't have... blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I just don't think that... I'm wondering if the principal approach to this is an easier one than the parent, than looking for a parent
well,
in the case.
There is no... But I think in what I'm hearing confusion. Once we get to any of the paradigms, we're going to mine it just the way we are in about 5 minutes for the principals. But the it's not that the principles speak obviously. So your hypothesis might be that you're entertaining is, well, look, if we just said, I go with the principle of autonomy, I don't have to go through the case, an example case in mind, I just go with the principle of autonomy and I apply it. The problem is there is no clear way, that an obvious way, that the principle of autonomy gets applied here. Because if you say... If your cashing out of the principle of autonomy is people have a right to know,
and a right to say they don't want to know,
but who has the right to know will still have to be asked, because does the donor mom have the right to know? Well, look, by the time she knows, she wants the kid back. Yeah, but see, the thing is, once you have told her this news, you can't go to a mom who doesn't have a baby in front of her and say, I've got some news. I don't know whether you want it, but it's about your egg. It's the choice that isn't. Now, I'm not saying do it or don't do it. I'm saying that if her autonomous view, if you could go crystal balling into her mind, if she would say, that's the kind of news I would never want, That would be her expressing her true autonomy. There's no way that offering her information could achieve it, because by the time you offer the information, do you want to know something? She's already going to have to say yes, I want it. And by the time you give it to her, you'll have already violated her understanding of what it means to be respected as a person. So it's the application of the principle itself is mired in difficulty.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just going to try and understand this and by analogizing to law for just a moment. Is it a situation where I have a case in front of me, it's a case of first instance, a case of sodomy that hasn't come up before. We're in Georgia back in the dark ages. I could pick a whole bunch of cases based on privacy and try to derive a principle of privacy and apply that, or I could apply a miscegenation type case and apply a sort of more of a civil rights analogy to that. And is it the issue that I'll end up picking paradigms based on what my core principles are? And then I'd be my
in case. In a case, it said beautifully, in a case where it's not obviously, that doesn't have an obvious ancestor. Whereas Cruzanne had pretty obvious ancestor cases, other withdrawal cases. And when it was the first withdrawal case, the question was, well, do people have the ability to decide their own health care and the rights over their own body? I'm not saying it's ever perfectly easy, but sometimes picking the paradigm isn't as straightforward as it is in other cases. And what does that say about casuistry?
Wouldn't it say that it is, although a powerful tool, has the weakness that paradigms may be picked based on the individual principles of the decision maker
yes.
in that particular
right.
case?
So what I'm trying to do with this case is show that picking the paradigm has some issues. Now, one of the things you might do is say, in a multifaceted case like this, you simply have to pick as many paradigms as you could mine to give yourself insight. And I'd probably go with that, because I think one of the big dangers would be you pick just one And then you have a very limited set in a case so novel and multifaceted that you've actually already cut out half of your tool chest. So you said, I'm going to go with a tool chest that has just power tools in it. Yeah, but you know what? Some of those other tools that you use in housekeeping might actually be able to be brought to bear. So in a case that is so complex, you'd want to be very, very careful about whether you limit yourself to one paradigm or you wouldn't even think so literally. You would just say, let's have all of the issues, let's just get all the issues out on the table rather than technically say I'm going to start with a paradigm, because this is a method that is supposed to simply allow for all of the moral principles and concerns at play to get out there, to see them all. So if you don't technically have to name your paradigm to work through, that's fine in my view, because as long as you're trying to be as expansive as possible, you may very much achieve the same goal.
But doesn't that run the risk of just that each case on its own, then?
Well, this is a very unique kind of case. So, but also, the way that we reason morally, we don't say, you know, that situation with my mother-in-law last week was just like that situation that I read. We might do that metaphorically, we might metaphorize situations. But really, I don't want us to say this is a rote and technical method as much as it is almost the spiritual method, a method of strategy, where you say, I'm not going to take just one principle, like the principle of autonomy, and try to apply it. I'm going to let this case speak in all of its multi-layers. Like, I'm going to ask, what happens to the self-identity of the child who ends up in some other home? What do we owe this child and her or his self-identity about knowing now that he or she is the product of this mistake, however it transpired? Or what does it do if the mom, the one who birthed the child, finds out but is not bound to tell the other donor egg mom? Does she bond differently? Does this child then, have we violated this child because somehow there's not the same amount of bonding? Or what type of genetic information does this mom now try to prevent this child from getting so that the child never finds out? Who knows? But you keep adding and adding and adding until you have, till you feel like you've got as robust a set of moral considerations on the table as you can get. And one of the ways in which casuistry dovetails or again harkens back to Aristotle, and think about Koshevsky here, is that it asks you to dialogue with others. That now this one's quite hard because you got some serious confidentiality issues. But one of the strategies that Aristotle advocated, and he got this from his teacher, who was Plato, was that there is great insight that comes from moral dialogue, from the dialectic itself. Plato wrote everything in form of plays. Why? Because they're all conversations. Why? Because the view of Aristotle and his teacher Plato, and Plato thought of it and imparted it to Aristotle, was that it's in conversation. Conversations like this, conversations that you have on a daily, you know, with confidants, with people you trust, with people who disagree with you, that conversation itself brings new insights to light.
Which is ironically called the Socratic method.
I know, in law, which is not conversation, exactly. I know, it's funny. I know, it is ironic. All right, let us turn, then. I think we've done our theoretical bit. The question here of... to discovery and move past how do we find a paradigm in a new field. Let's go.
Wait, what happened with that case?
In the instance I know of it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
The lab said nothing.
Did they go to the hospital ethics committee to help decide? Or?
Well, we're going to talk in a couple of weeks about the hospital ethics committee. Because, you know, that's not my favorite kind of institution. So I don't know whether it did or it didn't, but I'm not going to argue that it should have. Because what you'd have on a hospital, I mean, this is a particularly difficult case because you can't actually, once you've involved the involved parties, you've already actually made the decision to disclose. You can't have their involvement without already deciding that you want their involvement, and their involvement means their knowledge. So the idea of to not disclose prohibits any involvement of them. So that's why it's one of the worst cases I've ever had to think through. Because typically what you want to do is get the stakeholders involved to be talking about their own issues. And by this point, if that's what's going to happen, you've actually already disclosed.
Can I ask just a really silly factual question? Mm-hmm. Are they sure that the mother did not know? I mean, if somebody said we need your blood as a control, like, I wouldn't immediately think, well, you can't use it. Control means...
No, they don't know.
They don't... I mean, this may not have been an issue. She actually...
That's right. Unfortunately,
they
by,
do
the,
a process. Yeah.
By the time you find out that it is an issue, she already knows that it's not her egg, and she wanted it to be her egg.
Oh, no, I mean, isn't it possible the mother knew it?
Yes,
it
so it's well, it is absolutely possible
maybe
she used a donor.
They did this.
Of course, but the problem is that if it is, that if she did use an egg donor, she'll be like, yeah, duh, I used an egg donor. But if she didn't, she now knows that it wasn't her egg. The problem is there's no way to find it out.
But look, there's no way to say, can you walk me through the process of like why you chose to like use a fertility clinic? Like
how and then I say to you, how would you know I used a fertility clinic?
I'm not allowed to disclose.
Oh, wait a minute. I want to see. Do you see, Robin? Do you see how fast it happens?
Yeah, it does. But I mean, you can't just say.
I see, but why? Why are you asking me that? How would you know that I used a fertility clinic? And then you say, well, we skirted, huh?
There's something missing here. Like, you would have thought the lab would have been, I mean, the doctors got the results, yes? I mean, labs don't sit on results. Labs have to give the result to a practitioner. So then the practitioner has to know.
But what if they did? I mean, so?
So I'm assuming the practitioner would have had the knowledge, likely, or access.
No, because see, the thing is, the person who orders the test on the baby is a pediatrician.
Right.
A specialist. Mm-hmm. How would... So for example, my son had open-heart surgery at CHOP from a cardiothoracic surgeon named Tom Spray, head of the division, when he was 2. He does not know if I had infertility troubles. Why would he know? How would Tom Spray know?
No, it's not impossible they don't know, but they might have a fulsome medical record is all I'm saying. To make the assumption without doing a real workup to even know whether or not you have an issue here.
Oh, no, but, I mean, they know that...
The lab doesn't have a medical record, right? But the physician
but
does.
But let's just say, I mean, because we only use cases as generative of dialogue.
Fine.
But let's just say that it said IVF was used. Doesn't say that I used an egg donor. In fact, how many of the famous actresses and stuff, like John Travolta's wife just had, you know, or was pregnant, or was, I don't know, was having a baby. Is she publicizing that she used an egg donor? No.
She better be.
But she had to have.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Right? But she's not, people don't go around publicizing that they're using an egg donor.
No, I know. I'm just saying that before we assume, and I've seen it before, an ethical issue, it's good to do your diligence. I'm not saying it wasn't done in this to make sure that there isn't a practitioner who does know. You may not know.
No, of course.
But
it's always the easy way out if it says right on there, egg donor use. Whew. Oh, thank God. All right, good. You know, it would be great. But let's say they already did that and they're doing
that.
They might have just gone to the lab on their own.
Sorry?
They might have just gone to the lab on their own.
Right.
Well, I don't know here, but you typically, usually.
Well, for example, with BRCA, you can just send it away and you get, you know, the results back by the mail. And
I'm not sure I understand. Anyway. What if the clinician, well, Dr. Nguyen, the doctor decided to sit on there too?
Well, what she means is maybe there's an easy way out because maybe the doctor knows that it's an egg donor and everybody knows it's an egg donor. Maybe we don't have an ethical issue. Yeah. All righty.
Oh my gosh, it's 6:15. All right, holy cow. I didn't think it'd gotten that late. All right. We have 2 cases here, Debbie and Diane. We will not be able to get through this entire exercise, but we will get it started. Here's the thing. I think I can make the very uncontroversial claim that if physician-assisted suicide is ever, in your mind, morally permissible, and it may never be morally permissible, but if it's ever morally permissible, then I'm going to argue Quill did it right. Now, that could mean
Quill couldn't have done it right because it's never morally permissible. I get that. But I'm going to argue this is a pretty darn thorough approach to physician-assisted suicide if it's ever right to do. So if you're sitting there seething, saying, but it's never right to do, I grant you that. But if it were right, he, I believe, did it the right way. Now, I want you to quickly tell me, I'm not going to be able to write it all down, because we have 15 minutes to get from here to Debbie. I'll just jot little things down, but I want you to just throw them at me. What moral, and I can have a spot here for what you may not think is morally up and up. And don't tell me it was illegal in New York, because this is a moral question. It's absolutely not legal in New York at the time. But I want you to tell me what were the moral principles, what are the moral deliberative presumptions that you, and don't worry about formulating them in a formal way. Just throw out me what's right about this case. That's the question. What's right? What?
Autonomy.
Like what? But
she chose.
All right, so she chose. Good, go on, that's good. Come, hurry.
The doctor really made sure she understood the whole procedure and the 25% rate, and he really checked her.
Okay, so she had
an understanding.
Okay, it was right because she had a full understanding. There was full disclosure. Good. What else?
The doctor did the least amount possible in the situation.
Okay, the doctor was not over-involved in the sense of driving it. He didn't drive it as an agenda. In fact, not only did the doctor not drive it as an agenda, he tried to get her to not do it. He actually fought her on it. He said, no, take the chemotherapy, don't do this, I'll do pain, you know. And in fact, it turns out that Timothy Quill becomes ultimately one of the champions of palliative care movement. He ends up being and is now still someone who drives the pain relief movement and the terminal, they don't call that, palliative sedation movement, puts somebody into a heavy coma with pain relief until they expire, as opposed to physician-assisted suicide. What else?
She had a long history of disease at the beginning.
And what do you get? Why? What is her long history of disease? How does that make it right?
Because, you know, things like vaginal cancer, etc. She knows what it would be like to suffer through treatment.
Okay. So one of the things that makes it right is that she really knows what's the path in front of her.
So the quality of life issues is extremely
important. All right. Quality of life, she showed, were very important issues to her, rather than time. That we should know it was one of the reasons this is right, looks right, and done as a process, is because she said, I care more about quality than quantity. Okay, good. What else?
She saw a psychologist.
All right. So she tested out her own view by having a therapist that she could say, you know, this is explore her feelings, this is really what she wanted. It was not an impulsive decision. It was not a shoot from the hip. And it was a stable decision over time. So what I mean by that is, it's not that she said, Monday, you know what, I woke up today and I said, I'm going to have PAS. That's what I'm going to do. And then Tuesday she's dead. She thinks about it, and it stands the test of time. Her decision remains constant. Her resolve remains constant. She stays resolved to it.
She involved her family, so there's
her family was involved and aware. They didn't want it either. They tried to fight her on it, but she talked to them and explained how her understanding, and she got their support, their knowledge and their support, their awareness.
The doctor explained the mechanism of the barbiturates. So he felt that she understood whether she used it as sleeping pills or for suicide, was involved.
She even understood the path to her own death. So she understood, if you take it in this quantity, this is what it's going to do. And if you take it in this quantity, this is what it's going to do. What else?
She got the chance to say goodbye with proper dignity.
Okay, right. This idea of David Kasserat, who's one of the faculty members in the new department, has written a book which is wonderful called Last Acts. He's a palliative care physician. He runs the Wissahickon Hospice, the Penn Hospice. And he's written this book called Last Acts about the meaningful activity in the last weeks and days of life and how you can wrap up your life, tie up your life in meaningful and profound ways. That's what Diane got to do. Okay, what else? So I'll put that last tax. Should read the book. What else? The doctor had a long-standing relationship with his patient. He was not a specialist kind of relationship where you walk in, you get a consult, out you go. So he knew he knew her. And she trusted him, and he trusted her. Mutual trust.
It was self-administered, so there was no cord, no sense of cord.
Self-administered means that it had to have been her choice then, because she was the agent. And for a lot of people, the fact that PAS is often considered superior to euthanasia for that very distinction that I'm the one who did this to myself. That's why in the Jack Kevorkian trials, every single time he hooked somebody up to a suicide machine and the person pushed her own button for the death agent, he was cleared. But the one time he said, well, hey, there's no difference. You push the button, I push the button, who cares? When he pushed the button, he went to jail. Americans see a very bright line between I do it to myself and you do it to me. So this is a PAS case, not a euthanasia case. All right. Now, taking all that's right about Diane, let's look at Debbie. Now, I have to give you a little preamble here about Debbie. First of all, it may not be true. It may be a fictional story. Second, be careful about what you impose on the case of Debbie. What do I mean by that? There may be tweaks in the story of Debbie that make it right in your mind. Like, this is what Debbie really wanted. The problem is, as it's written, you can't put that into the case. If Debbie said, I want you to give me an overdose of barbiturates right now, morphine, so that I die, people in the room, some of you, will have a different view of it. So be careful of trying to put yourself in Debbie's place and saying to yourself, well, I would want him to do it. Read the case as it is, and then we can say, what would you have to do to the case to make it morally permissible in the way that Diane appears morally permissible? So you have to be careful how you read Debbie, because there's not much in it, and you could put a lot in the story, building your own mind, what we don't actually have evidence for. So let's put it like this. What if over here we said, what's right? What makes it right? Let's say here, what worries you? Let's not say what makes it wrong, because I don't know. But let's say what worries you morally about Debbie?
The duration of the event.
All right. How long from start to finish? We've got, I don't know, 6 minutes. Okay, what else?
Doctor was not familiar with it.
What?
Doctor
was unfamiliar doctor. Right. What else?
It was unclear what she did not clearly state what she wanted.
Exactly. Let's get this over with. It could be, get out of my room. I want to get back to sleep. I'm so tired of interventions. They never work. So just go ahead and try your intervention. It won't work anyway. So just get it done and get out.
The doctor notes that the patient was having like a desperate effort to survive.
Okay.
She had not given up.
Okay. And all right. So there's a couple of things in that phrase of desperate to survive. First of all, if she's got a desperate quest to survive, maybe she doesn't want to die tonight.
Right.
Could actually be an indication. Number two, think about the editorializing, the drama of it, a desperate. It's almost like, wait a minute, pal, are you caught up in the drama here, or are you actually looking at this from some measured perspective? So there could be two things.
But like, it's such a conflicting drama because, you know, the doctor acts in opposition to the statement that the doctor makes, like in the narrative.
Okay, so it almost sounds like, hey, pal, don't you see some conflicting evidence?
Right. And they see the conflict themselves, because like the conflict is pointed out.
Okay, so the very ambiguity of the case doesn't seem to be registered by the doctor. Clearly, there's some real ifs here. All right.
She deprived the doctor, and she doesn't really consult, as far as we can.
Interesting that you use the word she. Everyone in the room has a pronoun that's already picked out. You are not saying to yourself, she or he, she or he. You've actually picked one. And some of you have decided it's a he, and some of you have decided it's a she. But very few of you say, I don't know, she or he. I purposefully said she or he, so I didn't bias you. But people have, when they read this case is read in every medical school curriculum, people always, almost always, maybe it wasn't true tonight, but people usually have a pronoun they picked. Okay, this doctor is sleep deprived. Why does that matter? Why does that worry you?
It's like being drunk. Your judgment is impaired.
Judgment might be impaired. Okay, so I may not be thinking clearly. What else?
Oh my God, you wouldn't think that he would kill her because he doesn't want to stay there.
Well, yeah, right? I mean, one of the things could be that you,
I didn't imply that.
No, she didn't, but I'm going to. You didn't imply it, but I'm going to. One read would be, I heard her say, but wait, did you really hear her say? So your judgment could be impaired in the sense that you hear more than you think you hear. So that's the sense she meant it in. But I might actually say, look, you're sleep deprived. You just, look, she's going to die in the next couple of days anyway. This is what she wants. Who knows? So all right.
That's almost analogous to the surgeon who walks into a surgery, does something quite slapdash because he has to get back to his golf game. That is a real story, apparently. And the surgery goes wrong. You happen to be
Yeah, I don't doubt it.
She didn't really consult with the family member who appeared to be... Okay. Who appeared to be
all right. Family. So we've got a family member there. We don't even... We think. We have some woman by the bed. We presume it's her mother. We don't know. And the person was certainly not asked.
The patient as well as sleep deprived.
Yes, exactly. There's two sleep deprived. A patient not having a decision, if this is a decision, standing the test of time, but not even made in our best sense. How many times have you been so sleep deprived that you're just like, okay, fine, do it. Like you say to your kids, okay, fine, just do it. I can't argue anymore, or whatever it is. So judgments made in haste like that are already rickety.
The doctor actually calculated what it would take to kill the person, where the doctor could have calculated what wouldn't have killed the person, but still alleviated the symptoms.
Okay, there was no ramp up. One of the things that you would think is to say, well, now look, let's just all take a deep breath here. You're obviously not getting the right pain control, and you're not getting the right symptom management. Let's start with symptom management here. Even if that is what Debbie said, would you just be like, well, sure, absolutely. You want, you know, a big vial? Or would you say, look, I think this amount of morphine will actually let you sleep, get you comfortable, let's start with that. Even if euthanasia were legal in a country like the Netherlands, they wouldn't just say, all right, well, you know, load her up, all right? There's no attention to any symptom management. We're over here, there was tireless effort in how do we make you comfortable, what else can we do, what, you know, what right, okay, what else?
The doctor seems to have his own narrative about what's going on with this woman.
Playing almost a script. His sister died of ovarian cancer. Her concern is always that we don't let people die when we want to. It's almost like he or she's got a script running here, and Debbie just happens to be somebody who got cast in his play or her play.
Yeah.
Okay, what else? We're not talking at all about quality of life over here. What could make it better? What could be done? Is hospice a possibility? How do we meet your needs? We don't have any conversation about, Debbie, what would you want? What do you want your last acts to be? What can be done? How can we make this time meaningful? There's almost a prejudice that this time can't be meaningful. How do we know? If some of these symptoms could be relieved, if she could get out of this environment, if she's got weeks, maybe they could be a different kind of week with a different kind of activity. I don't know. We don't know what's possible.
Doctor administered as opposed to PAS.
Totally not Debbie administered. Exactly, it's done to her. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, I'm saying this is the worrisome category here. What else? All right, well, here's the lesson. Diane felt quite certain, if permissible, then permissible here. That's the level of certainty I'm talking about. Had all kinds of reasons we could see. And yes, you could now go back and say, the principle of autonomy, it's up here, sure. But there's a whole list of stuff here that is not just the principle of autonomy. You could find principles for all of this, and they're certainly important. Each one of these has got moral obligation through and through. We let the case just speak to us, what's right about it? And we said, here's what's right about it. And then we took all that, and we went to Debbie. And probably a whole lot more we took for Debbie. And you can look here, and maybe as our last moment, can you think about one thing we said about Debbie that was not a factor, wasn't just a tilde of Diane, something that the case spoke to you about that wasn't in Diane, something you saw in Debbie that was not material?
That Debbie was a young woman, and she had her life in front of her, or no?
Okay, that we didn't tend to say that. Could have been.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We could.
Maybe I could. Understand your question.
Of all the things we listed, and maybe that would want to be what makes it worrisome. I'm not sure it would. Okay, what if Diane had been young, but had cancer, since childhood cancer? Probably wouldn't have made any difference. I'm trying to find something that you saw in Debbie that we listed here, or that you want to now list quickly, that was not material in any way in Diane. Well, I mean, a lot of this was you know, sort of the tilde up there, but was there anything here?
Well, the progression of the disease was the biggest difference.
All right.
I mean, she was at the very beginning, and she was obviously...
So she had made the decision at the beginning of the disease,
yeah.
Whereas she had made it sort of off the cuff. But that is kind of related, because you can still compare them. Was there anything in Debbie that's... What did you say?
Uncomparable. So
yeah. You know, tea in China, apples. For, you know, Martians, apples. Is there something? Was there anything? Because if there is, then we could use it to say, well, that's what the discovery was like.
Are you asking what, in Debbie's case, we can apply to Diane's case?
No. I'm asking, is there anything new that you learned in Debbie that isn't just the negation of what you saw in Diane?
Was she because die anyway? But it was not a certainty that Diane would die. Is Debbie going to die? No, it wasn't a certainty in Diane. There's 25% chance of...
Oh, at the beginning.
Oh, if she had...
Yeah, way at the beginning. I don't know.
I think Diane never wasn't in the hospital setting. But she was in the hospital setting. And she was admitted. She was a patient.
Okay, so maybe there is something there about being in a powerless place that wasn't in the Diane case. The Diane case, that's an interesting one. So Debbie's powerlessness being in an institution she didn't control, an environment she didn't control, around people she didn't control, maybe that is a factor that we've got in Debbie that we didn't see in Diane. I won't keep you, but think about what to get, because basically we did this so quickly that the way that we did it, because it was quick, was to take Diane and tilde it, make a negation, and that was Debbie. But as you leave, think about whether there was things in Debbie now that you see that you learned just from Debbie that Diane didn't speak to. And if you do, that's the same discovery of principle that we're talking about here. Is there new tools?
That these sorts of decisions cannot just be made in a hurried manner. Like
but we said this one was not made quickly, so we had already said that here.
So new factors in the Debbie case.
Yeah, new things that made it wrong that had nothing to do with
new
Debbie.
Wrong.
Yeah, new wrong.
Oh, okay.
But
can you give one for us?
Or is there a new one?
tonight we didn't think of one. I'm trying to think of, like, what, you know. Well, here's one. If there was doctor drama, if the doctor, and you did say this, if the doctor was actually running a script and wanting to be part of some kind of star of the show, we didn't talk about the doctor trying to be the star of the show or not star of the show. So there might have been something icky about the fact that the doctor seems to cast him or herself as the starring role in this. And that you did all say.
And he was a resident, not even an experienced doctor.
Okay, and that could be another factor. Good, those were two. All right, off we go. See you soon. Remember that Tuesday we have the great Dan Brock as our colloquium speaker, so you don't want to miss that if you've got a Tuesday availability. He's one of the great founding fathers of the Art Catholic generation. And at Harvard, coming to talk.
If we have five as a conflict, we go to